The sea created this land. A long finger of sand dunes pointing into the Atlantic. The Maharees Peninsula. Came down here for a bit of a break. Chance to lie my back in the sun and enjoy a landscape where humanity isn't always in the foreground. I like the big sky and the ocean surf and the sandhills. It was all working out fine till I gave a lift in my car to a woman who turned out to be a biologist who was fond of toads.
Well, I was doing postgraduate studies on the frog at UCG with Kieran McCarthy in the late 70s, early 80s. And we realised that there has been very little work done on the toad. And there had been a paper published in the 70s just giving some new information on the distribution. So we decided that we'd come down and have a look around and see what the story is with the toad.
So how do you start? How do you find your first toad when you come down to a place you've never been to before?
Well, we came down first in the breeding season, and that's always the best time to locate amphibians because they come together to breed and they make a lot of noise when they're calling. And that's what we did. We just went to areas where we knew there were ponds.
And listened?
Yeah.
Would we be able to hear some of that?
Yes, we should, yeah. The weather is very warm and it's at the right time of the year, the end of April, early May, and we shouldn't have any problem in finding them.
So we could do that this evening, could we?
Yes, we could.
It's mainly in the evening that it happens.
Yeah, they on warm days, the toads call during the daytime, but it's usually in the evening around 7, 8 o'clock that they start to call, and they continue on until the early hours of the morning.
Well, it's early afternoon now. What could we maybe find at this time of day?
Well, if we went to some of the breeding sites, we should be able to find some toads in the water. They'll probably be floating around in the water, a few males, and we should, without too much problem, find a few other toads hanging around the vegetation. And if we're lucky, we'll find maybe some pairs in Amplexus. They're in the mating position. We should also find a few of young toadlets that emerged from the ponds, were spawned last year. They're hanging around. They should be hanging around the ponds, feeding at the moment. And also, because we've had good weather for the last week or so, some of the toads will have spawned by now, so we should be able to find some strings of spawn as well.
Well, here we are around the corner.
So the ponds are just here on the left behind us.
I guess this is a Wellington boot job anyway. It's going to be sloppy over there. How far are we walking?
Just about 50 yards over there.
Just 50 yards off the road in the dunes?
Yeah. Okay. There are two ponds just over there. And with a bit of luck, there should be some toads there.
Okay, I can hear a skylark already.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm ready.
Right.
I think it's amazing that there actually are these little ponds and dunes, because it's like a Sahara desert with all these sand hills around it. And then you come over the brow of one of them, there's this little wet spot.
Yeah, they're quite deep. They are just below water level, the wet spots.
Oh, look, there's something in the water down there. I saw it move.
It might be a toad.
I definitely saw a movement under the weeds there.
There should be some around here somewhere.
Ah, what's this?
That looks like a toad, all right. I'll just catch him there.
Oh, wow. There you are. Look at him. They're really not at all. Oh, he's trying to get away. They're not at all like frogs when you...
Whoops!
You said him. Can you tell the difference? He's hopped. Can you tell the difference?
Between a frog and a toad?
No, between a male and a female.
Male and a female, yeah. Well, this looks like a male. If you look at the front paw, there are the two inner fingers. There's a little black patch on top of the two fingers on each side.
It's lovely.
Characteristic of males.
He's a bit smaller than a full-grown frog, just That's a tiny nice. Bit, I suppose, and with this brown, warty skin and a very pronounced yellowish-green stripe all the way down the back. And underneath is this lovely sort of speckledy grey and white colour. And with these fantastic hands. And he doesn't move at all like a frog. Just put him down for a second and let's see what he does. He put himself down.
Their hind legs are quite a bit shorter than frogs, so they can't jump.
They sort of waddle. They sort of amble along this sort of rolling gait.
Oh, yeah.
They're so ungainly looking.
Yeah, I think they're great.
Yeah.
Let's pick him up again.
Yeah.
Oh, he made a noise.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. The males have this release call that it's a warning to tell during the breeding season if a male clasps onto another male by mistake. And they release this call which tells the male that's clasping it's a male, not a female.
And you picked it up around the body that time.
And it gave
that funny little croak.
Just
But that's not the same as the singing that you were talking about.
No. The singing are the males calling the females to the breeding ponds.
We better release them. But I see, when the females don't make that release call, so he's going off at a rate of knots there. This sort of funny combination of swimming and waddling.
Yes, that's right.
There's another one over there. Look, just coming out on that little bit of willow out there.
That's a big one.
Yeah, he is. Let's go and have a look at him.
It's a brighter one, too.
It's a different colour.
He's clasping
onto your fingers. He's a different colour. He's much greener.
He's much brighter. Yeah, he was hanging around in probably a part of the pond where there was a lot of green vegetation. And they take on the colour of the camouflage.
They change colour, like chameleons.
That's right.
They really are fascinating creatures. And where do they live? What's their natural history, their daily routine?
Oops.
Oh, let him go.
There you go.
That was another hymn, was it?
That's right, it was, yeah.
Okay. They're mostly nocturnal, aren't they?
They are, yeah. They hibernate during the winter months. And around this time of the year, in April, they come out of hibernation and head to the breeding ponds.
And where do they hibernate?
They hibernate at the bottom of pools or in burrows or under walls, under piles of stones, that sort of thing.
So some may be in the water, but others of them could just be burrowing into one of these sandhills.
That's right, yeah.
And at this time of year, when it warms up, they come out and go down to these little ponds and breed and mate. And then what do they do for the rest of the summer?
Well, after they finish the breeding, which would be sometime in June, they spread out for foraging, for feeding, and they spend the summer feeding, and they can go up to a mile away from their breeding ponds and amongst the dunes, the sand dunes.
And what do they eat?
They eat everything that moves that will fit in their mouths, you know. They respond to sort of quick, sudden movements. So insects would be the commonest food that they'd eat. And they've got this long tongue that they can, even though they don't move very fast, the tongue, they can lash it out really quickly. Their eye catches a movement and the tongue just goes out and wraps around whatever, a fly or...
And they do that mostly at night?
Nearly
always. And then they go down a burrow or something during the day?
That's right.
And they are quite threatened, aren't they? I mean, we don't have a lot of them.
That's right, yeah. Well, they're very precarious. You know, their lifestyles are very precarious. They're very dependent on the breeding ponds, on the maintenance of their breeding sites. And if there's any harm done to those in terms of land reclamation for drainage, then their breeding sites are very vulnerable.
And they have to be freshwater, these ponds?
Well, they can breed in brackish water as well, but it's usually freshwater. But some salinity is not a problem. But
full salt seawater, they couldn't manage it.
No.
And there must be a danger, because we're so close to the sea in all these sandhills, that in a big storm the salt water comes over and contaminates the ponds and things like that.
Yeah, to some extent, all right,
Not to speak of golf courses.
That's right. They need a particular type of breeding. They need shallow water to breed in.
Would you be worried about them then, about their future?
The toads? Well, I would, yeah, because, I mean, the population, they're just confined to this part, the Castle Gregory Peninsula, and on the Iver Peninsula near Glen Bay and Loch Eganavan. And as far as we know, they're the only two, and they're very isolated, small colonies of toads. So,
and we don't have a lot of reptiles in this country, do we?
We don't, no. We just have one reptile, the viviparous lizard, and then just the three amphibians, the newt, the frog, and the natterjack toad.
So if we lose one, we've lost quite a lot of our...
Yes, And Ireland has pretty poor fauna as it is anyway, so...
When you were working on them, when you were doing the research down here, you were talking about what they ate and so on. Is there any way that you checked that, or that you could work out that out scientifically?
Yeah. Well, I stomach flushed some toads when I was down here.
Stomach flushed them?
Yeah. I've flushed the contents of the stomach out of the toad without doing any without
doesn't kill them.
The toad. No. It's quite a straightforward operation. Just flushing water into the stomach, and I found just a wide mixture of insects, worms, snails, everything in their stomachs. But there was one particular population of toads that lived near the seashore, and I found with those that their stomachs were almost completely full of sandhoppers, which are
those little things that hop about like fleas in seaweed on the beach.
That's right, yeah. And I thought, well, they must be down on the beach. They must go down to the beach to feed. So one night I took the car and I just drove onto the beach. And sure enough, the tide was out, and there were the toads all spread out along the beach, feeding away.
You found them on the foreshore?
That's right, yeah.
What I'm really looking forward to is hearing this singing. I've heard so much about it, but I've never even heard it on a recording. Do you think if we came back tonight?
Yeah, I think the weather is very fine, so it's good to hear them tonight.
So Maria had got me hooked on toads. Well, that was okay. Only I did have a bad feeling about my relaxing break. I work in the media and I specialise in environmental subjects. And toads are great, but I had a suspicion they were going to crawl across that important bit of territory which separates holiday from work day. Oh well. And I was really looking forward to that evening.
I can hear something over there.
Yes, there's a good population of toads just calling in the pond.
Those are the toads?
Yeah, that's right.
We're creeping around the edge of a sand dune here. Is it necessary to keep quiet?
Yes, we want to. I think, yeah, we want to keep fairly quiet.
Okay. Yeah. Will they see us? It's not quite dark yet.
Yeah, I think we'd better get on our hands and knees at this stage.
Okay. We're now crawling on our hands and knees through the sand. As we come round the corner, there seem to be a couple of pools there on the dunes ahead of us, which is where that sound's coming from. Okay. God, it's amazing.
Yeah, there are a lot of toads calling there now.
Yeah, certainly are. For an endangered species, there seems to be a fair few of them left here, this particular spot anyway.
They're very gregarious. They collect together in a lot of numbers, you know, when they're breeding.
We're nearly at the water now. I suppose we'd better stop.
Yeah.
We don't seem to have shut them up anyway. That's the main thing.
No, when they really get going, it's hard to stop them, really.
So what exactly is going on here? What's causing all this noise?
Well, the male toads are doing the calling. They're the ones who do the calling. And they tend to park themselves around the edges of the pond and pointing oriented outwards. And they're sort of sitting up in the water, calling.
I think I can see one over there. I can see a little something in the edge of the water. A little.
Yeah. You can just see the heads.
That's what it is, the head. Yeah. Just about an inch or two from the shore.
That's right, yeah.
So that's a male toad?
That's a male toad, yeah. Most of the toads that you find in a breeding pond at any time are males, in fact, because the males come to the breeding pond at the beginning of the breeding season and they stay there for the whole breeding season, which lasts for about 6 weeks. And the females come in dribs and drabs and they lay their eggs and then they leave again. So it's mainly male toads that you find in a breeding pond.
And the females are crawling across through the dunes towards all this noise?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And why the noise?
Well, they do the calling to call the females to the ponds, and also there's a certain amount of competition going on in the breeding pond between the males as well. The pitch of the call is tied in with the size of the toad. You know, the bigger the toad, the deeper the pitch of the call.
Right enough, if you listen carefully, you can hear there is quite a difference between them.
That's
there's a very deep one over there on the right.
Yeah, that's right. I think there are one or two calling there as well who aren't actually in the water. That affects the tone of the voice as well.
And do the females like big toads?
Well, it depends on the size of the female, really. The fertilisation in the toad is external, you know. So how the fertilisation works, how good it works, depends on the size of the female relative to that of the male that she's breeding with.
So she likes one about the same size as she is?
No, a bit smaller than she is, in fact.
Oh. Like small toads?
That's right, yeah. But not too small at the same time. But she has a way of knowing what size toad will suit her size, and she can tell from the sound of the call of a particular toad. So
when she judges a call of a toad that tells her that toad is the right size, then she can swim over towards that toad. And the males have a very strong clasping reflex at this time of the year. So the male will clasp her when she comes close, clasp her just under her forearms. And then they're what's called an amplexus. And they stay together then for a couple of hours until the female is ready to lay her eggs. And they're fertilised just as she lays them by the male.
So you mean to tell me that if we'd been female toads crawling through these sand dunes instead of who we are, what we would have been listening for is we'd have been listening to all those voices that we can hear across the water there around these ponds and picking out one that sounded just right to be the right size to mate with?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Because that's amazing.
The female wants as many of her eggs fertilised as possible, so it's quite important to her.
So noise is really important in the lives of the toads.
That's
the sound
right.
is absolutely vital
yes,
to them.
Yes, that's right, that's right. And there's a good bit of competition going on between the males, you know, because there are a lot of males and very few females at any one time. So they do a certain amount of fighting as well and trying to dislodge each other from the backs of the females. So there's lots of activity going on in there.
And all sound related.
That's right, yeah. The males, if they clasp another male by mistake, they have this release call that we heard.
That we heard earlier on today.
That's right,
yeah.
That's right.
And how do they make this noise? I mean, it's actually loud. I mean, you'd hear that a long way away on a still evening like this.
Yeah, the natterjacks are known for their ability to have their voices carried long distances. They're passing air over and back across their vocal sacs between their lungs and the mouth, and they've got their skin just around the throat. They can enlarge it into like a big balloon, and that sort of resonates the sound, and it carries quite a long way.
Is all this noise going to go on all night?
Well, it's going to go on for a long time. On a good warm day, you can hear them, but they usually start around 7 or 8 in the evening, and they go on until 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, depending on the weather, if it's not too cold. But they really start up around 9 or 10 o'clock, just as it's getting dark.
It's a really exotic, tropical sort of sound. You don't really expect to hear it in sand dunes in southwest of Ireland.
Toads seem to be a symbol of ugliness in many cultures. They're something which, if you're not careful, you get turned into by a wicked witch. On the other hand, toads can sing very loudly and enthusiastically. And ugliness also is in the eye of the beholder. But it wasn't till I met Bernie that I figured out that this might be the swan song of a toad. That was a couple of days later, down on the beach.
Tony, we're walking up a great bank of shingle here. Behind us there's a surf beach, a marvellous surf beach, miles of it, and in front of us there's a system of dunes. I believe this is called a tombola. We're getting into the edge of the sand here. Can you tell me what a tombola is?
Well, it's the single shingle beach we walked over is the basis of the entire system. It's been generated by the rising of the sea levels after the Ice Age. From 8,000 years ago, they finally settled here, and above the shingle, the wind-blown sand
which is what we're trying to climb up here, and it's quite steep. Right. You better go first here.
Was trapped by the marram, which we are now walking into.
This is the marram, this thing looks like a sort of spiky rush. And this, as I understand it, is absolutely crucial to the whole business of sand dunes.
Indeed. It's highly specialised plant. As you can see, in this very dry conditions we have at the moment, it's like a rush, it's circular like a rush. In humid conditions, it opens up flat. And this is, cope with this, in order to help cope with these dry conditions, when it enrolls. Oh, and here we have a sea holly.
That's an interesting looking thing.
Which is...
It's like a sort of pale grey holly leaf peeping up through the sand.
Indeed. Very definitely one of the interesting plants of open sand dune. And in certain countries like Sweden now, very strictly protected indeed.
I notice already as we're moving back from the beach in through the sand dunes and this spiky marram grass that the vegetation is changing almost by the meter. But as we get back into the more consolidated dune system, every few meters, I mean, the marram is already beginning to thin out here, and we're getting what I would call ordinary sort of grass and herbs, and there's even daisies and buttercups growing up here.
Yeah, and this is the interesting area because one of the plants about to flower very shortly here is Arabis brownii, which is one of our very few endemic plants.
Endemic means that it's only found in Ireland, does it?
That's correct. And this, in fact, is its main national headquarters.
So it's only found in Ireland and it's only found in a few sand dunes, so it really is a very rare plant.
Indeed.
There's a dip over there on our left. The vegetation is obviously very different there. Why is that?
That's a dune slack, which floods in winter with the raised water table level.
So you mean that'll be a pond in the winter?
Exactly, and can be quite marshy, with a rather marsh type of flora.
We're getting
quite
down.
Quite separate and very specialised.
We're going down into a dip into this dune slack now, which is considerably below the level of the rest of the dunes, which I suppose is natural if it's an extinct pond bed. And you can hear as you go down, you can hardly hear the sea anymore, and we're into an area of skylarks and grass and something totally different. What I'd like to do really is to go over to, this is, as I said, an extinct dune slack or a winter dune slack, and it's now early summer and it's quite dry. I'd like to go over towards one that still has some water and have a look at some of the plants there. Could you take me across?
Yeah.
And this dune slack habitat is also on the top. So what kind of agricultural practice is it that threatens this landscape? And is it all negative?
Well, it's a double threat. The threat of drainage of the dune slacks and the fertilising of the entire system. It's the absence of fertiliser and, of course, of drainage that made the golf club site so important. Replacing something on that system with a monoculture is itself a disaster because inherently it causes a species crash. The absence of fertilizer and a very important part of the biology of this system is winter grazing by cattle, which wipes out the scrub and adds some body to the land.
So how big is the threat here? You're talking about golf courses. Okay, I mean, as far as I know, a small nine-hole golf course, sort of half-size golf course, is being built at the edge of the area. But are you worried that there are going to be more golf courses, that this is going to expand? Have you any information?
Yes, well, unfortunately, they're expanding and expanding exponentially. 2 18-hole golf courses and the further 9-hole golf course are proposed for the Mahari system alone. And on Inch, the southern Tombola, we have 2 further 18-hole golf courses, and who knows what else will appear there.
I think the toads at this June slack are beginning to sing a protest song about that already behind us there. So you're telling me that two more 18 holes in the nine-hole golf course, just in this area that we're in now. I mean, I don't know what acreage a golf course is, but that seems to me to be enormous. That seems to be a huge number of golf courses.
Indeed, and very important is that it removes the integrity of the ecosystem, and it's a very rare thing in Ireland to find a complete ecosystem and a complex one of this nature. And indeed, look, if we're looking here, we see down here this creeping willow.
Oh, it's a little, it looks like a miniature willow tree with little pussy willow flowers on it.
Indeed.
It's only about 6 inches tall.
It's a special subspecies which is confined to the dune slag system.
You mean it's only found around these wet ponds like the one we're standing in the sand dunes and nowhere else?
Exactly. And later on it will have beautiful silver leaves, which is what gives this subspecies its name, Argentea.
It's a beautiful plant, but if it's only confined to dune slacks, there can't be more than... I mean, you must count those almost on the fingers of two hands in this country. It must be very, very rare.
Well, not in the sense of being extremely rare, but because the dune slacks are under threat, it's therefore an endangered species for that reason.
How long have we got?
We can hear the natterjacks calling in the background, and they actually wrap themselves spawn is actually wrapped around the roots of these as well.
How long have we got? If this golf course development of the type that you're talking about goes ahead, when will we have nothing left to preserve?
Well, I would have thought a few years ago that we had forever. I've learned just how fragile, how rapidly sites can disappear because of the power of machines and the power of simply by spraying, as I say, massive spraying of fertilizer. Which is now happens in the mountains with the helicopters, and down here it's very easily done.
So are we talking about 1 year, 10 years, 50 years?
We could be talking about just 3 years, perhaps, for irreparable damage and loss.
Maybe I've spent too long in these sandhills. Maybe I'm becoming obsessed by singing toads and wicked golfers, a peculiar modern-day fairy story, perhaps an allegory for our times. This business of retiring to the wilderness to relax and get a fix on things is all very well, but it's possible to lose perspective as well as to gain it. I don't know. Anyway, when I did decide to go down to the pub for a drink and a bit of human company, I found the noise and the lights jarring my senses. And when I got there, they were talking about the same things that had been obsessing me.
Now, we set out to set up a local golf club, build a local course, nine hole. And we were very conscious of the importance of the area that we had selected to build the course on. And from day one, we acquainted the Wildlife Service what we were doing. We sought their advice. Michael John here went to the Turf Institute in England and sought professional advice at the highest level. And we were guided by those people. Now, the wildlife people from day one were aware of what we were doing. They inspected our course, and they were quite happy with what we were doing.
What about the natterjack toad?
Natterjack toad, we don't have it as a breeding area on our...
It's a breeding species on your
site. On our site. But we have intended digging a few pools out of our site, and they would serve two purposes. They would serve to create obstacles in our golf course, and which would be attractive. And we also have them designed so that an insect we thought could breed on them. And just 4 days ago, we discovered that they are actually breeding in one of our ponds.
Sean, how do you react to the idea that, okay, this is a nine-hole golf course and it's only on the edge of the dune system, but that it may be the toe in the door, and that there are ideas that the whole peninsula, the whole Maharis Tombola, may become just one series of golf courses?
Well, that is a possibility. As yet, all we can be sure of is that there will be one nine-hole course on it. But what you say is a possibility.
Would it worry you as a local man?
Not if the same care was taken in the construction of future courses as we have taken the construction of this. In fact, I would go so far as to say that possibly the future of our flora and fauna would depend on the golf course has been constructed with the care that we have put into this one.
But surely I won't have the same freedom to go for a ramble through the dunes with my dog and look at the plants and the animals in them if they're all golf courses.
Whether they're golf courses or not, the area is not going to stay as it is at this moment. You know, progress is inevitable.
You're both from this area. I mean, you're born and reared in sand dunes, or very close to sand dunes. It's the landscape you grew up with. Don't you feel a little bit depressed at the thought this may all going to be changed and there's manicured greens with Japanese playing golf on them?
That's putting it, shall we say, rather strongly. We are indeed concerned with the area. I personally have come back to live in the area by choice. I don't want to see it ruined. But it will change by creating golf. We will, first of all, we will enlarge our tourist season. It will be all the year round. We don't have frost. We have no snow. So apart from the odd wet day and windy day in the winter, the courses that will be created here will be playable around the year.
And do you think the people will be staying around here?
I do. I really do. I believe that.
I think that if it becomes a golfing centre, then it will be promoted as a golfing centre, and you will have an inflow of people, not just for a few short weeks in the summer, but right around the year. Now, I'm not suggesting that everything we do here by way of development should be solely golf. There are an awful lot of other things that can be explored. But our golf course is the first collective community effort to tackle the problem that exists. We have a declining population, we have an agricultural industry that's in the decline, fishing probably has peaked, it will be in the decline in the future. So golf is the first positive step. Now, there are many other things that we can undertake if this is a success. If we get the confidence by creating our own golf course with control.
An idle interest in singing toads had drawn me into a local conservation issue about sand dunes and golf courses. But it was only afterwards that I realised that it wasn't a simple issue, and it wasn't just a local one. The men in the pub had a point too. Human beings have an expectation that they can make a living on the earth, but it can't be done without changing that earth. A golf course will change the sand dunes. The toads may suffer. How important is that? That's the universal environmental question. What price can we afford to pay to support a destructive lifestyle? But if I come back to the Maharees in a few years' time and find that the sounds of golf have replaced the sounds that surround me today, at least I'll have a dramatic memory with which to confront the situation and help me try and find an answer to the question. The memory of the swan song of the toad.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.